From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, covering the Bush White House, which has been criticized for its lack of press access, we talk with Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Also, pitching jokes to President Clinton, Michael Katz is a speechwriter and humorist who wrote laugh lines for President Clinton's speeches. Katz has written a new memoir called Clinton and Me, a Real-Life Political Comedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Houston Chronicle reports that former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling has been indicted by a federal grand jury. The newspaper says it's expected that Skilling will turn himself in to federal authorities tomorrow. Skilling has denied any wrongdoing while he was head of the giant energy company, which went bankrupt in late 2001 at a cost of billions of dollars to investors and employees. Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean says he's ending his bid to win the White House, but he told supporters in Burlington, Vermont today he plans to remain an active voice for change within the Democratic Party. Bob Kinzel reports from Vermont Public Radio.
At a rally, Dean told his supporters that he wants to transform his campaign organization into a new movement, one that will continue to fight for the issues and policies that he's highlighted in the past year. Dean didn't endorse another candidate in the race, but he made it clear he'll strongly back the eventual nominee of the party.
The bottom line is that we must beat George W. Bush in November, whatever it takes.
Dean says he plans to huddle with his chief aides over the weekend to map out the strategy for his new organization. For NPR News, I'm Bob Kinzel in Burlington, Vermont.
President Bush said today that he's closely watching the debates over same-sex marriage that are taking place in Massachusetts and California.
I strongly believe that marriage should be defined as between a man and a woman. I am troubled by activist judges who are defining marriage.
The president said he'll support laws that protect marriage between a man and a woman, but he stopped short of publicly endorsing a constitutional amendment defining marriage. Iran's state-run TV is reporting that more than 200 people were killed today when a runaway train jumped its tracks and exploded in the northeastern part of the country. Roxana Saberi reports from Tehran.
A train carrying fuel and fertilizers that had been sitting near the station of Neshabur was somehow set in motion. The official state news agency says tremors set the unmanned train cars moving. But other officials said the tremors could have been the shaking of the blast itself. Reports say that when the train wagons reached the next stop, they hit another cargo train that had been stopped there, overturned, and started on fire. A local official says as firefighters and onlookers, including some local authorities, arrived at the scene, the train exploded. A handful of nearby villages were damaged by the blast. Hundreds have been reported injured, including many emergency workers. Many were taken to hospitals in Neshabur and the nearby city of Mashhad. I'm Roxana Saberi in Tehran.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow was down 43 to 10,672. The Nasdaq down 3 to 2076. This is NPR News. For the first time, astronomers have glimpsed what appears to be a black hole tearing apart a star and devouring the debris. The evidence comes from European and NASA satellites. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
The event took place in an otherwise ordinary galaxy called RxJ-1242-11. Stephanie Camosa is with the Max Planck Institute in Germany. She says observations taken years apart revealed a burst of X-rays.
The observations strongly suggest that a doomed star ventured too close to a massive black hole. The star was squeezed and stretched and finally completely torn apart. This debris would heat itself up and radiate brilliant X-rays until finally it reaches some point of no return and then disappears into the black hole forever.
Camosa says this is a relatively rare event. Estimates are that the black hole in the center of the Milky Way eats a star every 10,000 years or so. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Suicide bombers attacked a Polish-run military camp in Iraq today, blowing up two trucks loaded with explosives and killing at least 10 Iraqi civilians. More than 100 people were injured in the attack about 60 miles south of Baghdad. The Polish military commander said guards opened fire as the two trucks raced toward the entrance to the camp early this morning. One truck was hit, causing it to explode, and a second blew up when it smashed into a concrete barrier. Officials say the blasts caused the collapse of nearly a dozen homes near the camp. The wounded included Polish soldiers, Hungarians, Bulgarians, Filipinos, and an American. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 5 to close at 11:51. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's it like to cover the White House? More specifically, what's it like to cover the Bush White House? We invited Dana Milbank to talk with us. He's covered the White House for The Washington Post since the beginning of the Bush administration. Before that, he covered the White House for The New Republic. 4 years ago, Milbank reported on the primaries and the election, spending time with each of the candidates. His book about the election, Smash Mouth, was published in 2001. I spoke with Dana Milbank this morning. Has access to the White House or the way the White House is dealing with the press changed since the president's approval ratings have started to drop?
Well, to put it in perspective, it would be hard for it to get a lot worse because this is obviously the most restrictive White House there's been in modern times in terms of giving information to the press in press relations generally. Obviously, as you'd expect, the president's aides have become a bit more defensive lately because of, it started really with David Kaye and the weapons of mass destruction, and it's continued right through this whole flap over the National Guard, and not coincidentally with the president's declining ratings. It actually, in some ways, has a counterintuitive effect, and that is it forces the White House to be a bit more forthcoming in some ways. For example, dumping that large amount of documents related to the National Guard. The president sort of accidentally, I believe, agreed to do this in the Tim Russert interview 10 days ago. Said he would release all the records, thinking he already had released all the records, and his aides knew that there were indeed a large quantity of other records. Now, normally this White House would say, well, that's right. He may have said that, but we're going to do whatever we believe is the right thing to do, and we're not going to dump out these documents. But here you had the Bush White House putting out the president's dental records, showing that he had something like 9 cavities. He had a few wisdom teeth missing. Then they put out records showing rather intimate details from his medical records, including the fact that the future president, when he entered the National Guard, had a hemorrhoid. So this is something that you certainly don't expect this White House to be doing. So it is, in a funny way, the pressure that's on them has forced them to be somewhat more forthcoming, and somewhat in the same way that the Clinton administration scandals with Lewinsky and with Whitewater force the administration to dump out a lot of documents to try to get the bad news out there, to try to move beyond the story.
So from your perspective, what are the most important questions that still need to be asked?
On the National Guard situation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you could probably take a step back and say, is this really the most important story we should be following at the national political level? Does it really have that much consequence? We're following it because Democrats such as Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic National Chairman, and Kerry loyalists like Max Cleland have been making an issue of this. And it is a good story, even if it's not terribly important for the national debate. You could make an argument that it reflects on his role as commander-in-chief. So the questions that remain probably never will be answered. The larger question is why, being such an enthusiastic pilot, he said he wanted to have a career, a life in aviation when he joined the Guard. Why would he give up his flying? He was banned from flying because he didn't take the physical, which would have been a pretty easy step to take to continue flying. They did not have his type of aircraft in Alabama, but he could have flown a different type of aircraft. So it appears something happened in early 1972 that very much altered his path with the Guard and his interest in flying, and I suspect we're never going to find the answer to that because we don't have written records and we don't really have anything to go on in terms of people who have served with him at that time.
You mentioned that, you know, for the Kerry campaign, Bush's National Guard service is a good issue because Kerry, you know, was a war hero, and now if there's questions about President Bush's service. What about the Washington Post? How does the Washington Post decide whether it, as a news organization, considers this an important story, and how much play to give it?
The obvious standard is relevance to the national debate, and I think what drives it is the credibility of those making a certain accusation. So when Terry McAuliffe, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, says the president of the United States was AWOL, well, that's a story that that we have to pursue. But this whole business, for example, last week with Matt Drudge putting out the rumor of John Kerry having an affair with an intern, the Washington Post did not mention that for many days, and that was because there was, first of all, there was nobody credibly making that accusation, which makes it different from the National Guard issue. And there was no basis in fact that we could find to justify writing about that story. And there's sort of the standard of truth, a standard of relevance, and I think particularly important is the standard of who is raising these allegations. We've at the Post have had a lot of criticism earlier in the Bush administration, indeed the whole news media in general, for not taking on the president, taking on the White House, and challenging them like we did during the Lewinsky scandals with the Clinton administration. The key difference is the Democratic Party was largely asleep for the first few years of the Bush administration. They were out of power in the Congress. They didn't have the ability to investigate and issue subpoenas. They were intimidated by the president's standing after the September 11th attacks. They weren't taking on the president. And then people were wondering why the press doesn't. Well, the press largely follows the national debate rather than setting it. So it really requires an opposition party to make an issue of something before the press will really jump on board. The press may mention it, but it's not going to make a campaign out of it without an opposition party doing that.
So when there's an allegation about an affair or, you know, a personal thing like that, the Washington Post decides to investigate a little and see if there's anything there before deciding whether it's worthy of coverage or not?
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, the typical way these rumors wind up is in the mainstream is they wind up on the internet, then they wind up in the British publications, which seem to have a lower standard of accuracy, then they make it into the American tabloid market like the New York Post, and eventually it filters into the mainstream. If there's accuracy to the rumor, then of course we're going to be covering it. If there's no accuracy to the rumor, most likely we'll do it as we did this week, and that is have our media writer write about everybody else writing about it.
You referred to the internet and how certain political rumors start through the internet. You've written in this presidential campaign, keep an eye out for internet stories from both sides. What should we be looking for?
Yes, this is less in terms of the rumors that I was writing about there, but actually in terms of their advertisements. The new campaign finance law requires that if you put an ad out on television, the candidate himself has to appear on the end and say, I approve this message. So if you have some nasty attack, well, the candidate himself looks nasty. Internet ads are exempt from this. So it's no accident that the Bush campaign just came out with an internet ad that was really quite nasty, attacking John Kerry, saying he is beholden to special interests. The president didn't have to get on there and said, yes, I'm the guy who authorized this message. John Kerry is responding in kind, also on the internet. And a lot of people in the White House have told me that we can expect a lot more of this, that if they want to inject an issue into the campaign, a negative issue into the campaign, doing it through the internet on their own websites, or actually, in the Bush case, what they did is they emailed it to 6 million people, their supporters and media types. In fact, it's a lot cheaper than running an actual televised ad. It gets picked up anyway, and they didn't really have to pay anything for it. But this is the way they can inject something negative about the opposition into the debate without, I mean, they have some fingerprints on it because you know where it came from, but the candidate himself doesn't have to appear to be the one spreading it.
So you can get around certain regulations of commercials by doing these ads on the internet.
You can, and in the old days, long ago in the year 2000, you could actually run televised ads that would take on the opposition without the disclaimer with the candidate approving it at the end. But this is an important way in which the new campaign finance laws have actually changed the tone of the debate in the current campaign.
My guest is Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. You've said that there's very little access to the Bush White House, and that's been consistent throughout the Bush presidency. In what ways do you feel access has been restricted? Explain what that means.
Sure, and it's always the sort of the role of the press to whine about not having enough access to the president and to his people. But the Bush White House has been particularly good at this from their point of view, effective at this from our point of view. They said right from the start, we're going to be the no-leak administration. We're not going to announce something until we want to announce it, and then when we announce it, everybody's going to say exactly, you know, read from the same list of talking points. They've been extraordinarily effective at doing this. In fact, it's only been very recently that we see that breaking down in any serious way with, for example, the book with all the damaging quotes and documents from the former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. We've seen the breakdown with David Kaye and his testimony on the weapons of mass destruction. The prediction had always been that when an administration gets in trouble, that's when its message discipline, this is sort of the no-leak mentality, begins to break down. So we are seeing some of that. But even now, to an extraordinary extent, this White House has sort of designated a couple of people to deliver an official line to the press, and the others just plain and simply will not speak with the press. So, for example, people I would have spoken with in the Clinton administration, the chief of staff, the top advisors and strategists to the president, are largely off limits. On the rare occasions you do get them on the telephone or in person for interviews, they very much stick to the script that you've already received from the twice daily briefings you get from the press secretary.
Has President Bush given any interviews to the Washington Post?
He has. This was in the year 2001. And he's given several interviews to my very senior colleague, Bob Woodward, but these are for books that he's done and which are excerpted in the Post, but are not expressly for the Washington Post. He's granted, obviously, far fewer interviews than previous presidents had. The Post has not been singled out. He's given very few to many publications, and in fact none to a lot of publications. He prefers what he says to go around the filter of the media and speak directly to people in terms of speeches. And that's why he wanted to do the Meet the Press interview, where it really is not filtered. The question is asked and the question is answered. Now we can argue about whether that was effective for him, but he does not like it when an interview is done and we get to pick and choose which quotes will be used.
So what was it like for you as a White House correspondent to watch that interview between President Bush and Tim Russert?
I guess it doesn't speak well for the way things have gone in the newspaper business that we must sit around on Sunday morning to gather quotes from these folks who go to the Sunday talk shows. We were pleased that he did it because, look, if he's not going to give a lot of press conferences, and he's only had about 10 of those in his whole presidency, which is a very small number, historically speaking, we're at least happy to have him out there answering questions at all. That interview wound up starting this entire National Guard furor, or at least fueling it to a large extent, because that's what forced him to dump all these documents out there. So if we can't have him ourselves, which would be our first preference, or we can't have him in a regular press conference setting, which would be our second preference, then okay, we'll watch and let NBC take care of that.
Do you think Tim Russert did a good job?
Yes, I do. He perhaps was not as firing away with as many questions he does when he's in the studio, but you have to consider he's in the Oval Office with the President of the United States. And he did get him to go further than he had in saying that he was surprised and believed that he was, in fact, getting close to an acknowledgement that he was wrong on the weapons of mass destruction. Making that promise on the on the guard records, which was very shrewd. The president got in his talking points. In fact, at one point, Tim Russert tried to interrupt him to cut him off, and the president said, "Let me finish." Then on went on with the long spiel. And the next thing we know, that is being used as an advertisement for the Bush-Cheney campaign. They took his answer, showing it that it was from Meet the Press, and put it to soft music about how we're, you know, feeding the hungry and taking care of the needy, put in the new photo backdrops, and you had an instant ad. In fact, NBC complained to the Bush campaign, and they wound up dropping the ad.
What was the complaint? That it was being used out of context?
Yes, that it was. They were using the words uttered in Meet the Press, but it made it look like they were sort of a party to a presidential ad, and if they're going to use excerpts from the interview, they should use it in the without adding their music and images to it.
Huh. How much analysis do you put into your coverage of the president? And here's an example. You were writing about the president's budget, and you wrote, "President Bush has often vowed to, quote, make sure that our first responders, the brave police and firefighter and emergency management teams, get resources necessary to do the job you expect them to do, unquote. But he proposed an 18.4% cut in funds to first responders, an $805 million reduction the administration says is justified because it does not believe those funds are, quote, targeted to homeland security capabilities." Okay, so you mentioned this cut in money, and you mentioned how it seems to kind of violate a promise, and then you mentioned what the Bush point of view on that is. So another way of covering this would just be fact. This is what they propose for first responders, and not even mention that it seems to violate a promise. So how deep do you want to get into analysis when you're covering a story like the release of the president's budget?
Right. Well, the White House would complain that all we do is analysis, and in fact, that's why they want to get around the filter and just put the facts out there. Hopefully, we're doing that on every story that we do, because if we're not going to blow the whistle and say, okay, well, the president's saying this in his budget, but this contradicts what he said yesterday or last month or 2 years ago, or that if it's just flat wrong, then nobody's going to realize that. And often this White House has been very successful by sort of putting out their version of the facts, and by the time people sort of get around to figuring out that that wasn't quite right, well, the original story about the president said X is on A1, and then the story saying, well, that maybe it wasn't quite right the way he said that is mentioned in paragraph 6 in a story that's deep inside the paper several days later. So I view it as my job, and I think many others in the press corps do as well, to hold the president accountable, first of all, to the facts as can be assessed, but also to his previous words in terms of being consistent. So this is perhaps another byproduct of the limited access to the White House, that you do a lot of sort of textual research. One of my best sources is LexisNexis. So president says this today, I plug it in and go back and see what he had said previously. On the White House website, I perhaps shouldn't say this, or they may go and change it now, has a marvelous search function where you can plug in any word or phrase and find out any time the president uttered it. So it is a byproduct of the way this White House works that a lot of what you need to do is analyze in some Talmudic way the public utterances of the president and compare it to other utterances and compare it to other available facts.
Has the White House responded to you directly about any of the articles you've written?
Oh, sure. I don't think I'm alone in this, but particularly early on when Ari Fleischer was the press secretary, he's a screamer and would sometimes get in my face with the spittle flying and more often call and holler at my editors and work his way up the chain of command there. His successor, Scott McClellan, is much better liked by the press corps and is much more mild. He'll certainly raise his objections, as will plenty of others in the White House, and it's not unheard of for them to have a very reasonable complaint about something, and if we've gotten something wrong, we'll go ahead and fix it. But largely after the first couple of years, the incessant complaints about my coverage or about the Post coverage have stopped as they've realized that that's just the role we play.
What did you get the loudest screams about from Ari Fleischer?
You know, it's funny that you'll write something you think like, I'm going to, you know, hide under the bed tomorrow morning because, you know, you've just, you know, called the president some horrible thing, and you get nothing at all. And then you'll write some innocent story and they'll call up hollering about, you know, in paragraph 16, you said there was a mirror over the mantle and there is not a mirror over the mantle. It mystified me at first. What I think it is, though, is the president goes through our newspaper and a couple of others each morning, and I bet he's marking in red pen something that he doesn't like, which would explain why they're willing to go to the mat over a seemingly trivial issue about the placement of a mirror and let something which would seem to be much worse completely go. But the times they react the worst are when you question the president's credibility. In fact, I did a story in October of 2002, and the headline was "For Bush, the Facts Are Malleable," going through a whole bunch of things on the weapons in Iraq and some economic claims and other things, and doing, as I was saying, you know, comparing that to the factual record and the things that he had said before, and indicated that a lot of these things he was saying just weren't true. That was certainly the worst point of relations that I've had with the White House.
Dana Milbank covers the White House for The Washington Post. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, running President Clinton's comedy war room. We talk with Mark Katz about his work during the Clinton administration, adding humor to the president's speeches. And we continue our conversation with Dana Milbank about covering the Bush White House. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dana Milbank. He's covered the White House for The Washington Post since the beginning of the Bush administration. He previously covered the White House for The New Republic. You said that you think the president reads the paper and then takes issue with certain facts in it, but I've heard that the president doesn't read the newspapers, that he gets his information from his aides. Is that not true?
Well, of course it's not true, but it's very useful for the president to say that that he doesn't read the papers. And what he's really saying in that is he doesn't care about what's in the papers. And he says most Americans don't read the papers. This is sort of his appeal to the common man. But I know from my colleagues that, they'd bump into him at a Christmas party or something, and he'll mention some obscure item that was written about in a gossip column months before. He is very, very smart and very much interested in sort of the political horse race, and he reads his coverage closely. Now, that's not to say he reads everything, but he is reading the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and he is briefed on all kinds of other coverage by his aides, and the White House assembles packets of the day's clippings. I'd be very surprised if that doesn't make it to his desk as well. We even find out, and it came up in the last week or so, the president often watches the daily briefings that his press secretary has given, and those things are awful, and you can fall asleep while you're watching them. But here's the president. Can't you picture him like sort of munching on some pretzels and a non-alcoholic beer and watching his press secretary get pummeled? But sort of my inclination is, well, why doesn't he come out and give a press conference then rather than watching it? But he follows his coverage very closely, and it's politically useful to say, you know, I don't watch the news or read the news, that doesn't wash.
Why doesn't he come out and give more press conferences? What is your opinion about that?
Well, it's pretty straightforward, and that is he's trying to redefine. He says that at the press conferences, the network correspondents get up there and primp and preen and try to show how smart they are, and that is exactly what they do. So I don't blame him for that. What he's realized is if he can, after every few days, he will take two questions. Generally, it's from the Associated Press and Reuters, or maybe Bloomberg or something like that, at the end of a meeting with a foreign head of state or some of the cabinet. By taking those two questions, he lets the steam out. The pressure does not build for the full-fledged press conference. He knows what questions he's going to get because he knows exactly what the issues of the day are. He's been briefed on it. He's prepared his response. Now, when he goes and has a full-fledged press conference with 20 different questioners, you don't really know what you're going to be asked. In fact, that's when he's made news about the Catholic Church and gay marriage. He's just not expecting these issues to come up. So he would rather have a very controlled environment where he takes a couple of questions, delivers the comments he wanted to on the news of the day, and avoids sort of the essay response format of the press conference. And from his point of view, it's very smart. It's just rather frustrating from our point of view.
My guest is Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Vice President Dick Cheney used to be the CEO of Halliburton, and Halliburton has been in the news a lot lately because of overspending problems in its reconstruction efforts in Iraq. And in that respect, it's possible that something that was seen as an asset of Dick Cheney's, his work as a CEO, can now be seen as a problem for him in a reelection campaign. Do you think it's a done deal that Dick Cheney will be President Bush's choice for his vice presidential running mate in the reelection campaign?
Well, I do, but I should preface that by saying I thought it was a done deal that Howard Dean would be the nominee. So my predictions aren't worth very much at all. But here's why on Cheney, and that is because, number one, he has already said he will do it, and the president has already said he will have Cheney on the ticket with him. And this president's main strength as a manager and as a leader is his loyalty, and to go back on that at this point would go far beyond what the president could do and maintain that central strength of his, and it would also be a terrible blow to the conservative base, which really adores Cheney on most issues at this point, particularly on foreign policy and on economics. So I really don't expect that to happen. But there's no doubt that the Halliburton has been an endless source of headaches for this administration, and the vice president, while he still has financial links to Halliburton, does not have an interest in the company's fortunes anymore, so he can reasonably claim that he is not tied to the company. But it began with the asbestos litigation and legislation before Congress. The White House had a very difficult time touching that because Halliburton was involved. We have the overcharging in Iraq, and even when the president came out earlier this year and announced his plans for eventually a manned mission to Mars, stories came out a couple of days later saying, well, guess who's been working on a manned mission to Mars? It's Halliburton. So these folks are, the problem is this is a massive conglomerate who is everywhere. So anytime the administration takes a step in anything in the overseas, the oil business, defense-related stuff, they wind up crossing paths with Halliburton. So even if there is done completely innocently, there's always going to be this shadow over it that the president is doing this to help his vice president's old buddies. So it's definitely become a real albatross for the administration.
Do you have any more or less access to the vice president than you do to the president?
Less, if that's possible, but and that's not. I'm speaking, I think, for the entire press corps on that subject. He has granted very few interviews, other than his meet the press format, which he likes, and he's done a good bit of conservative talk radio, but very few interviews with the mainstream media, with only a couple of exceptions in the last 3.5 years. Has not allowed journalists to travel with him on Air Force Two, and obviously we travel on every flight the president takes on Air Force One. He does not, with, again, a couple of exceptions, give press conferences. He is, obviously, his retreat to undisclosed locations has become something of a running national gag, but it is true that you just don't see the man, except for his occasionally popping up on a hunting trip or at a Republican fundraiser. But he has decided that it is not part of his duties to communicate with the press by and large. And apparently we don't have a right to demand that.
In 2000, you covered the presidential campaign, and you spent time with all of the candidates. You wrote a book about that was published in 2001 called Smash Mouth. How do you think President Bush compares to the candidate Bush that you knew during the campaign?
Well, let's see. I mean, there are many ways in which he is unchanged. I mean, you could certainly see in terms of the managing of information that we've been talking about today was very much the way the campaign operated back then, the ability to stick to a message and to stick to a fairly limited number of big policy proposals and follow through on them. So there's very few surprises in terms of the president's way of operating or his personality, very much the same one we saw back then. In fact, you can see a lot of the as they prepare for the upcoming presidential race, you can see some of the same tactics that he was using with Al Gore, with John McCain, are beginning to resurface again. It's not surprising a lot of them are the same advisors who advised him the last time around. So if there's no difference from what I'd seen back then in terms of style or in terms of personality, there has been something of a surprise in the emphasis of his administration, and that is that his campaign was largely based on the compassionate conservative, the going beyond the tax cuts and the national security issues to really getting into domestic policy issues to help the underprivileged. Now, I have no doubt that the president cares genuinely about that. In fact, I'm certain of it. It has not, however, been a priority of his administration to the extent it was a priority of his campaign message. And some of his aides have said as much to me and said, you know, that's just, you know, we didn't expect September 11th to happen, and that's a result of that. But so in terms, we've definitely seen more conservative than compassion in terms of the policies he's put forth. But he's very much the same man in terms of the style of leadership.
Do you ever have nightmares about your work? You know, the equivalent of showing up late, or like you have a test you haven't studied for. Do you ever have that type of nightmare, but applied to covering the White House?
Terry, my work is a constant nightmare. No, I still have the sort of the high school test anxiety dreams. But I think you can't really survive if you do that in this business. You just at deadline, you just put the story to bed. Put one last read through to make sure you didn't make some grotesque error. And then, you know, if you blew it, you're going to find out in the morning, and that's what we have the corrections column for.
Okay, and while you're not having nightmares about your beat, are there stories that you've written that have kept you awake at night?
I suppose. I mean, there's sometimes you dread the reaction that a particularly tough story will have the next morning. I mean, I do like... I actually like the president, and I like a lot of these people I'm covering, and you have to take a step back and say, you know, be that as it may, you know, he said something that's wrong and false, and I've got to call him on it. And so you don't look forward to that first conversation with the president's aides after that story, but, you know, maybe there's a couple of sleepless nights early on in the beat, but now in the fourth year of it, it just... I can get through the night pretty well.
Dana Milbank, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dana Milbank covers the White House for The Washington Post. Coming up, writing jokes for President Clinton's speeches. We talk with Mark Katz about his new memoir, Clinton and Me. This is Fresh Air. Mark Katz describes his work during the Clinton administration as running the comedy war room. His job focused around the annual series of humorous speeches the president gave to the Washington Press Corps. Katz worked as an adjunct member of the White House speechwriting staff on retainer by the Democratic National Committee. In his new memoir, Clinton and Me, a Real-Life Political Comedy, Katz recounts his experiences getting the president to make his audiences laugh, often by having the president laugh at himself. Well, you know, you talk about how self-deprecating humor can be, you know, very funny, but it doesn't always come naturally to people. It comes natural to you, and you think that's in part because you're Jewish.
Yeah, self-deprecating.
but you say it didn't come naturally to Clinton.
No, he came from a place, Arkansas, where humor is a stick you beat other people up with. And it's kind of the Washington model to use self-deprecating humor. And it's something... you need to become accustomed to. You know, being savagely self-effacing is something that's only reflexive to the most practiced and perfect practitioners of power and your average Jew. And so I kind of, you know, had this great opportunity and kind of worked my way into the room. This happened over a long period of time. I started out doing clips on the Dukakis campaign in 1988, and I would look into these meetings on the other side of the door and try to figure out how to get into that room. And over time, I found that humor was was the license I had to get into that room. That was my ticket. And when President Clinton was elected, and I was asked to kind of put together some material that he might say at these annual humor dinners he does at the, you know, White House Correspondents' Dinner and the Gridiron Club. That's how I found myself being escorted into the Oval Office, sitting across from him, and pitching him ideas and sharing ideas for jokes, quite honestly. And he jumped right in. He enjoyed it. We spent a lot of time. You know, each speech, we would probably spend 45 minutes to an hour trading jokes. I would go in with my pages of stuff, and he had ideas. And there were other kind of high-ranking White House aides all around us. And there are a lot of, you know, talented, smart, funny people in politics. And it was just one of these great, rare, wonderful occasions when, for an hour on a day, it was all about sharing jokes, trading jokes, and getting this guy ready for the big speech he had to give live on C-SPAN that Saturday night.
It sounds like you really enjoyed working with President Clinton, but there was at least one joke you wanted him to do that he was very uncomfortable doing. And this had to do with an egg timer. How did you want him to use the egg timer?
I wanted him to use an egg timer to kind of solve that week's weekly crisis, which was a speech he had given that went on far too long, the State of the Union address in 1995, a speech that went on for an hour and 21 minutes. And that very same week, he had a speech at the Alfalfa Dinner, an annual humor dinner. And my idea for him was to walk to the podium without saying a word, pull an egg timer from his pocket, set it to 5 minutes, and put it on the corner of the podium and let the room have a big laugh along with him and kind of concede the fact that he had told given a speech that went on far too long. And he just did not want to concede the point, quite honestly. At that point, you know, you got to remember it was a low point in the administration. It was just a few months after the 1994 midterm elections. And he rejected the idea of the egg timer and wound up, you know, basically rewriting the speech. You know, the speech was kind of predicated in the egg timer. By the way, when the egg timer was going to go off, he was going to add more time each and every time. He rewrote the speech up on the dais, and it didn't work out well. He gave a speech that was meaner than it should have been and tried settling scores, and that's not the best use of humor. But before the evening was out, even as the speech was not going well, and he could tell that, he pulled the egg timer from his pocket and said, "Maybe this will help," and got the big laugh of the night. And he took away the lesson from that he needed to learn, which is that humor is best used when directed at yourself.
Did you ever misjudge how a joke was going to go over and find that your guy had to pay the consequences for having said this in a speech?
You know, there was one joke in 1998, where the museum, the news museum, came out with its rankings of the biggest news events of the 20th century. And on that list, somewhere around number 63, was Bill Clinton getting impeached. And based on that, we had a joke in one of his speech, basically the president complaining about being ranked number 63, you know, especially given all the hoopla. And the punchline was, "What does a guy have to do to crack the top 50? Okay. Now, to our ears, and this went through the entire West Wing, to our ears, that joke was about, you know, what does a guy have to do other than getting impeached to crack the top 50? The room, however, heard it very differently. The room heard, their mind went to the specific, you know, indiscretions that created the impeachment.
Right.
And they heard the joke as, you know, what specific, you know, personal activities would a man have to do to crack the top 50? And no one in the White House ever anticipated that joke and that laugh, you know, at the snickers, really, quite honestly, that we did not hear because we just were so ensconced in our own bubble of, you know, what impeachment was. That joke was a good example of a joke that kind of got through this very, you know, very difficult and vetting process. And even that joke kind of had a consequence that we never saw coming.
My guest is Mark Katz. His new memoir, Clinton and Me, is about his work writing jokes for President Clinton's speeches during Clinton's two terms in the White House. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Katz, and his new book, Clinton and Me, A Real-Life Political Comedy, is about his years writing humor for President Clinton, for Al Gore, and for Michael Dukakis. You did some running for Al Gore when he was vice president, or for him a little bit when he was running for president. You talked about the importance of self-deprecating humor. Was it hard to convince Al Gore to make jokes about his image as being really stiff?
You couldn't tell Al Gore a joke that would upset him. He had an amazing ability to see himself from across the room and know the kind of jokes that Al Gore needed to tell. And I had great experiences working with the vice president because he was fearless. I remember trying to talk him out of a joke once that he wound up giving because I thought it kind of crossed over a line that he liked so much.
What was the joke?
The joke was it was in the middle of the Gridiron Dinner of 1998, and he had been asked to fill in for the president when the president. No, it wasn't 98. Forgive me. When did the president break his leg? Probably 1997. And he was on the dais, and someone whispered a joke to him, and the joke went something like this: Trent Lott had made kind of a nasty remark about him that week. And someone had whispered a joke to the vice president saying, the joke went like this. Trent Lott, the Democrats have gone very far to up their standards on campaign finance reform. Senator Lott, up yours.
Did he say that?
Someone pitched him that joke. And the next thing I know, a Secret Service guy is tapping me on the shoulder. Because the vice president wants to go over this joke. And in the room that night was also Al Franken, a friend of the vice president's and a very funny man, obviously. And we huddled in the back room of the Capitol Hilton, and the vice president wanted to know what we thought of that joke. And there were some other White House vice president's speechwriters there, Dan Schnoor and Eric Pink. And Dan Pink and Eric Schnoor. And vice president wanted to know what we thought of this joke. And Al Franken said, it's a very funny joke. And Schnoor said, it's very funny, you should use it. Dan Pink, very funny, you should definitely use it. I had actually heard the joke before in various incarnations, and that devalued it greatly to me. I think a person telling a gridiron speech especially should kind of use jokes that aren't, you know, well-known already. But then I became nervous, you know, what if the room gives it an ooh, which is kind of the Washington equivalent of the referee calling it out of bounds, ooh. And then I thought, well, even if the room doesn't give it an ooh, what if Trent Lott makes noise about it and, you know, on Monday and Al Gore has to apologize for it on Tuesday? Who needs that? So I, in the process of sorting all this stuff out, I said, I don't think you should do it. I'm sorry. And, that's when Al Franken pitched a saver to the joke. He said, well, in case the joke doesn't go well, here's a saver you can use. You could say, hey, come on, the venerable master loved that joke. That was a joke about the a reference, which is very timely at the time, about the Buddhist monks. And I said to the vice president, sir, if that joke needs a saver, you've already lost. He said, well, we'll see. You know, I'll decide what to do once I'm up there. Well, sure enough, Al Gore takes the stage later that evening, tells savagely effacing jokes, and you got to remember he was in the middle of his own crisis. This was in the middle of controlling legal authority, and fundraising phone calls he made from his desk at the White House, which was at odds with federal laws, and so he made savage jokes at his own expense on those very topics. I mean, that night. We opened, we did a little bit of stagecraft where the spotlight hit him on the dais. He's on the phone talking, and the room is silent, and the whole room is silent. And then he looks around and he says into the phone, I'm going to have to call you back. And then stands up and gives this speech, all predicated in. One of the premises of the joke is you got a lot of good jokes off me on this topic, and I'm going through a hard time. Here are some jokes you missed. And he tells the jokes that they missed all on himself, all about his crisis of the week. And later that night, as before the speech was over, he told the Trent Lott up yours jokes. Got a huge laugh, and dared to go where I begged him not to go. And it paid off. It was, so
Do you think it's because he had earned so much goodwill by being so funny up to that point?
I think so. I believe it is my thesis that once you've been sufficiently self-deprecating, you have earned the right to be self-deprecating on behalf of others. And by that point in his speech, he had done that.
Mark Katz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mark Katz's new memoir is called Clinton and Me. Katz is a speechwriter and humorist whose company is called the Soundbite Institute. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Keeping Watch, a novel of psychological suspense by Laurie R. King, author of Folly. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dick Cheney and Halliburton. We talk with Jane Mayer about her article in the current New Yorker called Contract Sport. What did the vice president do for Halliburton? I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.